ask you. Carlos, thank you very much.
Okay, no, thanks to you and organizers for inviting me. So yes, I will talk about dark matter searches. I understand that the high energy part of the exciting high energy part of IceCube was discussed a few weeks ago. I am thanking it in absentia these people because I was told yesterday to give this talk, so I have to grab things a bit quickly. And even if they don't know, I took from them. They are IceCube colleagues, so there's nothing external. Okay, so I usually start my talks with the conclusions while I have your attention. So, as you know, we are taking data with IceCube with the complete detector since May 2011, so we have 2 years of data with the complete detector. We have already some results from the first year of 86 strings, and with 79 strings, also the results are coming out. It takes some time with IceCube to analyze data. You have to take the data out of the South Pole, and well, part of the 86 strings data is also analysis are coming, so not all the analysis are done at the same pace or speed. And one of the, I think, amazing things of ICU, which was not in the original design, is this deep core, which is just six additional strings, we'll see later, in the middle of the detector, which allow us to lower the threshold to about 10 GeV. And if you go 20, 30 years back in time, the design of IceCube and the design of neutrino telescopes was aiming at the highest energies possible. So we cover the highest energies, but with this very simple addition of six strings closely packed in the middle, we have we're able to reach to lower the threshold to a few order of 10 GeV. The first impact of this is that we have converted IceCube to an all-sky detector. It's not only for northern hemisphere. We can see there for the galactic center. And if you want to look at the sun, for example, which is half the year up the horizon, half the year below, with this deep core, you can look at the sun all year round. So you double the exposure directly. So we have some limits on dark matter searches, which I will show you today. And from here on is what I will not talk about today, but okay, you know we have first TV, PV events, and we have sensitivity to point sources, which are already rejecting models, standard models of high energy neutrino production, maybe for example in GRPs. But okay, I will not cover this. I'm not sure how familiar you are with IceCube technicalities. So this is how it is for the theorists in the room. We have strings between 1.4 to 2.4 kilometers down, 60 light detectors per string, separated 17 meters vertically. Each string is separated 125 meters between them. And these red dots here are this deep core subarray, which is these six additional strings, still 60 optical modules per string, but the vertical separation is about 7 meters. So it's closer in X, Y, and closer also in Z. So it's a kind of dense array. Okay, I will not enter into the hardware details. So let me argue first why this deep core, I find it particularly useful. First of all, this is the effective area of the detector as a function of neutrino energy. The effective area is a concept we use in neutrino telescopes, which if you want to, hand-waving argument is kind of efficiency to detect neutrinos. It's actually the area you would have if you would have 100% efficiency to detect a neutrino. So actually we are building a cubic kilometer thing, which is actually a meter square if you would consider it as a 100% detection area. The point I want to make here is that if you take only IceCube without these infill deep core strings, this is the effective area or the efficiency to detect neutrinos, and you see it goes quite steep down with energy. When you add this deep core, you get this red lines, so you gain quite a lot at the low energy side. Still, between 10 GeV and 10 TeV, you have a few, several orders of magnitude of efficiency. But at least by adding these strings in the middle, you gain something in this area between 10 and 100 GeV.
If you continue below 10 GeV, the curve, does it?
No, it really drops. That's the first point we could reasonably get something out.
And the error bar, is there an error bar in those points? Or?
I don't think so.
We have a different shape. What do you think would be a realistic error on the effective area?
We usually have a 20% error. There's another issue. I mean, there is no unique effective area. The effective area depends on the analysis you're doing. Because it depends on the cuts you make. If you're looking, you're concentrated on low energy, for example, you would make cuts which reject all these things, and your effective area might look like that. If you look at point source searches, for example, which are concentrated on high energies, they reject this area. So that's something for theorists. There is no a unique effective area of a neutrino telescope. It depends on the analysis you're talking about. So it's usually wrong to go to a IceCube or Antares paper, grab an effective area, and use it to test your model, because it might not have anything to do with the spectrum you want to focus.
What are the units on the lattices?
Sorry?
What are the units on the lattices?
Sorry, square meters. Square meters and log 10 of energy. And again, this is at actually, what I want to show here is just the just that with deep core, you increase at this energy. This is effective area at trigger level, so what the detector sees. Once you apply cuts, this curve will go down. And it will go down at least an order of magnitude. So from trigger level, from what the detector triggers on until what we see at the end of the analysis because of our cuts, cut away, I mean, you have some efficiency in the cuts, the effective areas drop a lot.
Is this integrated or averaged over the whole sky or
something? This is averaged over, that one I think is over the northern hemisphere, on angle, yeah. Yeah, there is another dependence on effective area, which is a bit on angle.
Do you know that one?
What?
You know that the one has a functional angle?
Not here.
Yeah, theorists would find it really useful to have a series of these at different zenith angles.
Yeah.
That would be super useful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Of course, I mean, we have it. I was thinking for the full detector, things are a bit less dependent on zenith angle than as before, because the detector is already as big like this as like this. The only thing which enters is that, of course, the vertical separation of the optical modules in this direction is that. But there is of course.
That's the one part we can't model very well ourselves. So that's the one thing we need.
Okay. We usually don't show it. we are more usually interested on the answer. But yeah. Okay. Another thing we have to fight is this. I have seen a lot. So if you look at the angle where tracks come from, this is vertically upgoing from the center of the Earth, horizontal and vertically downgoing. The Earth filters everything, so if you look down the Earth, we only have the atmospheric neutrinos, so we can easily reach the neutrino level and see for any excess from direction. If you want to look up, you have the atmospheric muon background, which is about 6 orders of magnitude bigger, which was a problem up to now, and you might have seen always IceCube or Antares neutrino telescopes show sky maps and do analysis using the Earth as a filter and concentrating on half of the sky. However, now IceCube is big enough that you can, for example, define a veto region, require events which do not have any hits in the outer strings. So there are events which are entering into the detector. So something which doesn't leave any trace here and starts in the detector, it has to be a neutrino. Atmospheric muons will come and cross the detector from above and leave signals outside. So if you are able, well, if we are able to define the Vito region, define starting events, which are for sure neutrinos, and then you convert the detector as an all-sky detector. And you can actually reject the muon background and reach neutrino level also from the southern hemisphere. So it allows you to look at southern hemisphere sources, in particular the galactic center, and as I told you, also the sun when it's below the horizon at the South Pole, and all kind of point sources if you want to make a point source analysis. These we could.
If the area for this type of searches would be smaller, right? I guess.
Not the energy dependence then is very different, because you don't have the high energy part, because at some point you saturate the detector, so you have to look for something which leaves, which starts already inside. It can exit on the other side, but it has to start inside. And also we have some analysis which require that things start and stop inside the detector. So what you, let's say, screw up if you want is the energy dependence on this thing. So the energy dependent, the neutrino energy, we are sensitive in this hemisphere, and this one is quite different.
Which is saying, so this is more or less equivalent to identifying a fiducial volume for your detector.
Yeah, it's like creating a super K if you want.
There should also be a limit to this technique, right? Because if the effective area of the normal ice cube Vito volume is too small, then you can't see any starting tracks and neutrons, right?
Sorry, again?
Well, basically the effective area of the rest of ice cube is too small that you don't see any tracks in the Vito volume. You couldn't see any tracks at these energies, and you can't use the technique, right? So you need to go to energies where the effective area of the rest of ice cube is at least big enough to see any tracks.
Not sure I follow, because even at these low energies, low energies, of course, will...
Compared to deep core, the effective area is suppressed by, what, 2 orders of magnitude or even more?
Yes, but, I mean, there are two things you can do. Even if you wouldn't have deep core, you could still define this volume, and you could define the starting tracks here. You will have a lower limit on the energy you can detect.
Yeah, there. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, yes.
So there's only a limited energy, right?
Yes. What deep core allows you is to lower a bit even more. But yes, I mean, yeah, there are limitations if you want to look at this part of the sky, but we can do it. And I will show you examples where we have results with that. Why I'm insisting in all this? Because for many years, people were thinking of neutrino telescopes as half of the sky detectors, because you need to filter the neutrinos. But when you get to big enough volumes, you can go around this logic and also have the detector as a 4π detector. OK, so coming to dark matter, I have a shaded area in my screen, which doesn't show here, which highlights this part, which is the part where we have analysis on. With neutrino telescopes, you can do this. You know, there are many candidates which you can address by other techniques, and you have limits on all of them. With IceCube, also I know Antares people, we have concentrated on these generic WIMPs. We also have analysis looking for supermassive particles. So the idea is, okay, let's look at objects where dark matter can have accumulated gravitationally over the evolution of the universe. in our neighborhood. This means looking at the sun, the Earth, or the galactic center or halo, or nearby galaxies, dwarf asteroids. And we have analysis for all these objects. What I was mentioning before, our galactic center lies, in our case, in the southern hemisphere, and it's only now with the big detector that we can use this Vito region to look for neutrinos coming from the galactic center. The sun at the South Pole is between 23 degrees below the horizon, so during the winter, we can just use the Earth as a filter and do the normal analysis. During the summer, it's 23 degrees above the horizon, and we have to use these Vito techniques to make analysis. The experimental part is quite model independent, so you either see something or you don't. If you want to interpret things, then you have all the uncertainties you can think of and you want, about from astrophysics to particle physics, etc. But as an experimentalist, you just look for an axis of neutrinos from.
To an extent, right? Because the kind of gas you do will depend on the kind of.
Yes, because in the end, you put the limits to what you simulate. And you have to simulate the signal to optimize your cuts. Right. Yes.
So it's not really totally.
It's not completely. But we can jump over some of these things as experimentalists. One thing I was talking to one of you before. If you look at the sun, and you look, for example, a 5 TeV neutralino annihilating in the sun, or a 10 to the 16 Simsilla annihilating into TT bar inside of the sun, the neutrinos have to get out of the sun before reaching us. So this curve here is the neutrino energy of the W decay at the center of the sun, at the annihilation point. However, these the dashed curve here is the energy of the neutrinos that we see at the surface, at the detector, at the Earth. So all this energy has been lost getting out of the dense interior of the sun. Not only that, in the end, what we see in Ice Cube is muons. So part of the neutrino energy goes into the muon, is lost into the muon, but it's lost into the shower. So the muon gets less energy. So if you start with 5 TeV neutrino annihilating at the center of the sun, what you see in the detector actually is 100 GeV. Muon. The same, kind of the same for some cells. So if you look at the, if you're looking at the sun, somehow the sun itself filters the energy of the original neutrinos, and you're always looking at kind of a low energy analysis. So this is not some, this is something that doesn't happen if you talk about the galactic center, or the Earth, or nearby galaxies where neutrinos just come from the annihilation direct to us. So if you want to eventually make a correlation, if you would see something and you want to make a correlation between the energy of the neutrinos you see in your detector and what is going on in the sun, you would have a lot of unfolding back to do. And
you're looking for W's, the neutrinos, for the channels?
Yes, we're going to, this is an example.
It's softer, right?
Yes. Yes, I put this as an example because this is the extreme higher. So even in this extreme higher case, you get very low energy muons in the detector.
It's just a statement that the scattering length and absorption length, and the length for that corresponds to the interaction scattering length trying to get out of the sun is on the order of a couple hundred GeV. So you can explain those you expressed about that. That's all it is.
Yeah, it's just, and there's no weird physics here. It's something that usually people don't have in mind. Somehow you talk about you're looking at 500 TeV and you say, then you will have high energetic neutrinos, and you don't.
It's a little lower than that, right? Because when you've shown the neutrino energy is not
lower,
it's even lower.
The muon energy is.
The neutrino energy.
The solid
line
is
muon.
The solid is muon.
Oh, okay.
And this dashed is neutrino. So, yeah, I mean, there's no big deal. It's just to make people aware that that's the point. Okay, so let's start, going to the actual analysis. This is the latest analysis we have done with the detector when it was with 79 strings. I don't know if you know, IceCube was built in stages, a few strings added every year. So at some point, we had 79. And this was the first time that this deep core was also active. So this was the first time that we could do this veto trick. So this is the first time we could look at the sun over the whole year and use practically the whole year as a data set. We have more than 60 billion events recorded, at final level 25,000. And we divided the analysis in the data set in three independent sets. The usual ones you know, which is upgoing things crossing the detector. That's the standard analysis we had been doing always. We defined also upgoing, but starting the detector, or actually contained, starting and stopping. And since we can define this fiducial volumes, we also defined downgoing, starting, downgoing tracks. So this covers the whole energy ranges and the whole year and the whole sky. So this is from the northern hemisphere. This is from the southern hemisphere. And this is the energy of the neutrino that you're sensitive to in these three sets of analysis. W starts stands for winter, means the sun below the horizon. You can use the Earth as a filter. And you have the high energy and the low energy sample. So this is winter, high energy sample, low energy sample. And this is summer, where we only have the low energy sample. So this goes a bit in what you were asking before, the different energy ranges you can achieve by imposing these cuts. So for the if you go for through-going tracks, you are about several hundred GeV or TeV energy, most probable. When you define contained tracks, you're down to 40, 50 GeV, most of them.
Is it Monte Carlo working? The Monte Carlo.
Yeah, this is the Monte Carlo. Because you have the real neutrino energy, which is hard to get. So how do we do this in the end? In the end, what you're looking at is at the distribution of events in the sky. And you look at the difference between where they come from and where the sun is. This is the expected atmospheric neutrino distribution. This is the angle to the sun in radians. The dots are the data. And if you would have a signal, you would have some peak towards the sun. So what you're doing is you define this kind of function, which takes care of the angle distribution of signals, so this kind of curve. And the angular distribution of background, which is this. You define the likelihood of this, likelihood ratio, and you evaluate how much of a signal you can allow in your data. In this case, the signal simulation doesn't let you see that actually our data and expected background matches. So there is no visible excess.
What happens to the background going to zero?
Sorry?
What happens to the background once it's off?
This is a phase space thing. So the number of events.
Solid angle there.
Yes.
Well, it's a total number, it's not the
differential. Yeah, it's a phase space, solid angle.
So where does the structure in the background come from?
This is also this. Effect of the solid angle.
No, but I mean, isn't it larger angular distance? I mean,
when this peak.
Yeah.
That is also
reflective area, right? Function of sine.
No, this is in principle is related also with the phase space of the angle of the solid angle between the track and the and the sun position.
But we only saw that
ice cube's bigger, longer this way than this way. Is that fair?
No, because we are talking more or less horizontal things. So it's not an effect of effective area of angle dependence of effective area. As I understood it in his limits day, which I don't remember, you can argue it from the solid angle point of view, I think. Okay, I can check it.
I don't understand. What do you mean
by the solid? But the phi space of the angle between the tracks and the sun, and the position of the sun. So you're looking at the sun and all the events, you're calculating the.
Well, the direction between the neutrino and the muon.
Not even.
No, this is the direction between the track, the muon track, and the sun.
And the sun.
Yeah, I know, but you were expecting the neutrino to come from the sun. So it's the opening angle between the muon and the
balloon. But we're trying to figure out why the two peaks.
You wouldn't. You wouldn't get this peak. Okay.
Is it obvious that it goes to zero to at 2 pi because 2 pi corresponds to the entire sky, right?
It's
pi in radius. So this is pi. This is that.
Pi is something like this, the opposite.
Yes, this thing is like that.
All right.
So that is a small solid.
So if you have if you have this peak, I think you have to have this peak because of that. So
yeah, it's. So why isn't it symmetric then?
Here.
Well,
maybe we can go back to this and try to figure it out.
Okay, I have a hypothesis. So, if you're looking straight up, you have ice top to veto the atmospheric.
Yes, but we don't use that.
And now you
don't. No, it's a geometrical thing. As I understood it once.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Signal simulation is a you. You simulated also the angular resolution.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That's why it's so broad.
And the neutrino muon thing and the angular resolution of the muon in our.
So this would depend on the energy.
On so this is, for example, for one TV neutralinos annihilating, it will depend on the mass or the energy.
Okay. It doesn't matter whether the neutrino is coming from the sun or not. You're looking in the direction of the sun.
Oh, we're
doing
a large
size. The size is an angle to the sun, so they're splashes all.
Let's go back to the
drawing. Okay. Now, from your this angular distributions of data and background, you get a 90% signal contribution. This is just a bit technical, just to show how we do things actually. So because this is your observable. What comes from your from the distributions I just showed before, when you make the likelihood analysis. So this is the first observable you have. Then the detector is characterized by the effective volume and the life or effective area. In this case, effective volume, because we're defining starting and contained tracks. So it's not an area. It's actually a volume, what we have, a detection volume. So what actually you get directly from your observable is this kind of quantity, which is, if you want, a volumetric flux, or how many interactions, how many signal interactions per volume and time you have in the detector. You want, in the end, to get a muon flux, or you want, in the end, to get cross-section limits, as you will see in the next slide. So you have to go from this measurable quantity to something else. And here comes a bit of theory or phenomenology, if you want. Because this, how many interactions you have in your detector, is related to how many annihilations are happening in the sun, how many neutrinos are actually interacting in your detector producing muons, Bratzian ratios, and distance to the sun. So that's the way of going from our measured quantity to what is happening in the sun, actually. And now once you have what's happening in the sun, how many annihilations per second you have in the sun, which would produce as much of these events or less, you can define the muon flux at your detector. And once you define the muon flux at your detector, you can plot the muon flux as a function of WIMP mass. And since we have simulated a few neutralino masses, you get the muon flux limits for a certain amount of models.
How much data is this?
This is 1 year of data. Well, not this, what I'm going to show. This is actually an old plot. I'm just showing to see how we do things. Because what we do not measure the muon flux directly. What comes out of our analysis is this quantity, which is actually this. But now that you're at this level of the muon flux, you need some model of your particle physics that or neutralino model on how it goes into different branching ratios.
Sorry, what is this? The subject region is a particle model, particle physics model, or
this?
What
yes.
Model is
so this is the MSSM. I think it was a 25 MSSM. It's not a scan as you do. It's just a kind of
problem scan.
Yes. Yeah. And this is for two. So we were talking before. You can do this for assuming different annihilation channels. So this is for the BB bar, and this is for WW. So we do at this level. We do not have these multi scans, which you include all the information at once. So we do this. We do this for BB bar and WW as a benchmark. Okay, so this is the results. So this is another way of looking at the plot I showed you before. In this case, it's cosine phi between the sun and the event in a much narrower region than before. Predicted atmospheric neutrinos in dashed lines and data in dots. For these three analysis I showed you, starting up going and starting down going. So if you want, this is a kind of muon flux you see, and then since the muon flux you see at the detector is related to how many annihilations are going on in the sun, and how many annihilations are going in the sun is related to how many neutrinos are captured in the sun. And how many neutralinos are captured in the sun is related to the neutralino proton cross-section. If you measure this, you can go and put a limit on the neutralino proton cross-section, which is what we have done here, both for spin-independent and spin-dependent. The ice cube results of 1 year of data are the red lines for assuming full annihilation into VV bar and assuming full annihilation into WW.
Is this 22? How many strings is this?
This is 79. Yes. So this is the latest results we have, which were published.
No, last week, your MSSM colleague was showing us ice cube 22 results.
Sorry? What?
So you have an MSSM dedicated analysis.
That's a bit different. Yes, that was using this technique where you do not do...
That's right, you do a full model.
Why? Because we only have publicly available, we only have right now the iSCOOP22 data. This is still not public data. So this is the latest, which was published last month in FISREV letters, iSCOOP 79 2011 data, 1 year. Compared to Xenon, CVMS, the CMSSM, including constraints from direct experiments. This has been independent, and this has been independent.
So the lowest energy is about 20?
30.
Well, that's mass, not energy.
Oh,
yeah, well, this is the mass.
Mass
of the neutrinos. Yeah, so this is neutrino proton cross section as a function of neutrino mass. It's also the first time we reach so low masses. And this is because these contained events, we can define contained events, which are low energy by definition, and you can also look at downgoing and upgoing, so you double the lifetime.
But this is the full detector, no? 86?
79.
79, huh? What is the difference with respect to that one? What do you expect to improve?
Right now, because of the size of the detector, not much. Because between 86 and between 79 and 86 strings is not much increase in volume. So from now on, it will be either improving techniques in analysis techniques or just accumulated lifetime.
Yeah, but the low energy probably you
would improve from because the amplifier is. We could increase just because these the 7 strings which are missing between here and 86 are on one edge, so they defined, let's say, they improve the veto from one side. So you might, when you analyze 86, yes, you might improve a bit on the low energy part because you make the veto a bit more efficient. But it's because of the veto, it's not because you increase the volume a lot.
So what's the effective threshold? Since you're constraining 30 GeV, it doesn't matter. The threshold must be pretty low.
Threshold of neutrino energy?
About 10.
Yeah, about 10.
Good.
Yes.
10 for iSCOOP.
Deep core, and deep core.
No, this is actually.
When?
No. iSCOOP 79.
With. It includes the 6 deep core strings. So if I go up very much, iSCOOP 79 is without this layer here. So iSCOOP 79 includes already deep core.
Right.
What is missing was the last wall, if you want. So that's why iSCOOP 79 already lowers the energy quite a lot because we can do deep core. What ID6 will increase or will improve is the veto from one side because we will have one layer more of the strings.
So is it fair to say, if you go back to the part you were discussing on sensitivity with 79, is it fair to say that for the next 5 years, what we can expect is an improvement of a factor of few?
You can expect these, at least these 2 points, maybe this. So this is lower with respect to the rest of the curve. So this curve will not change in shape. It will just go down just because of the lifetime. These 2 points, I think we can improve more than the lifetime because of this additional layer, and because it's the first time we're using analysis with these veto techniques, and I think the analysis itself can be improved.
So high energy goes with square root of time, right?
Yeah.
Because it's back on getting the value. So, yeah. So in 5 years, a factor of 2 or so, and low energy maybe a bit.
I respect that, yeah. Yeah, so this is where we stand now. So in spin dependent, we are quite competitive if you want, at least at this energies of hundreds of GV mass. So it remains to be seen what we can do at this level.
And how is this to be read to find in the dotted line? Is the truth probably most models somewhere in between?
Yes. Yeah. So we chose
lots of models above and below those benchmarks too. Yes.
In what sense?
If the limb annihilates to tau or to neutrinos, it's even better. If it annihilates to muons and electrons, it has no neutrinos. So, these aren't the bookends. These are reasonable benchmarks. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In addition, the
tau
is included there, right?
In this case,
below the GV
Below the W.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Below the W mass, we have tau. Yeah.
Oh, otherwise there wouldn't be any tau.
Yeah. Okay. Obviously. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So anyhow, you're right. It's kind of benchmark. In principle, what you should do, and we are starting to do, and we have this talk by Pat Scott last week. It's a kind of global analysis where you do not assume a single annihilation channel. You get the model and you get the right weight for each annihilation channel, and you predict the neutrino flux already from the whole model.
Sorry, I still didn't understand. So which one is the tau on this the tau channel?
For masses of the neutralino below the W, so these two points, we assume the tau, annihilation to tau.
I mean, in the future, it might be nice to have a W line and then a tau line, because that tau line is going to go way below the W line at higher masses, right?
I wouldn't expect so much.
Every tau decay gives you a neutrino. Yes. Oftentimes, multiple tau neutrinos. That's not true of W's. So, I'm pretty sure that.
Yeah, but the in the end, what
this line
comes.
That's something like this, I think.
It's not
true. I wish. Okay.
It makes your experiment look better. You know, I don't. That's the reason you should.
So this is an old slide, but I didn't get the updated ones. Just to put in perspective what colliders do and what we do. So it's as old as I'm using Fermilab limits. Is it set anything? For Tevatron. So collider searches are also in this game. This is from the Tevatron, also neutralino mass and spin dependent cross section. Assuming missing jets, monojets in these PP collisions, you can transform you can make this cross. The diagram cross, and you get the spin dependent cross section. So they can deduce the spin-dependent cross-section neutralino proton. And they have, at least at some point 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the Tevatron had this shaded area here, which reach quite low neutralino masses. And they are not so good as high energy masses. So if I transform this shaded area into our previous plot, which is a bit distorted because the scale is different, this is where they reach. Below neutralino masses of 10 GeV. Remember that we start at 30. So they are competitive in this area. So
I think actually they see, right? They have found it.
Yes, they have found it. So that's why it's better than that, yes. So that's why I'm saying this is an old plot. It's just to show which region they are. But they are still in this very low region and lower. So we have competition in this area from the experts.
And I don't think we can get around that.
However, they are not so good. So the LHC also reaches thing 1 TV now. So, but it goes quite up. So we are still in the game at a few hundred neutralino mass GeV.
You couldn't get that a neutralino, right? So this is not supersymmetry necessarily, right? Yeah. This dark matter model would have affected
the GeV. Yeah. Okay. I was just to show that.
And none of the operators at the LHC is sensitive to applied neutralinos.
And okay, and also, yeah, so this is very sensitive also in which type of. So these results are very model dependent. So, but it's just to show that if you want to be optimistic, we're complementary to accelerator searches.
By the way, there you can, I guess you can also see what you're saying, right, about the tau and W's. I mean, on the right hand side, I suppose the first three dots on the red curve are tau's, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then the fourth one's W, so the tau's are really going steeply down. Yeah.
How I'm doing with time, because I...
So you have 7 minutes, or let's say 10, 15, whatever you need.
Okay. Well, just to mention that we don't only do MSSM, you can do Calusa client limits, and we have in ASCII put a limit on the Calusa client parameter space. So the game is the same. These guys are supposed to annihilate into neutrinos. So once you have the data, it's just a matter of interpreting them in terms of Calusa Klein modes.
The line there, it's really Calusa Klein, so it takes into account all the branching ratio. It's again a branching ratio 1 into some.
No, I think in this case it was.
I mean, it's a consistent model.
Yes. Yeah, because there's no so many possibilities in this case.
I think it goes mostly into.
It
goes mostly to leptons, which gives it a higher rate of neutrinos.
Yeah, so it's a consistent model.
Okay.
Yeah. We did also an analysis on super heavy dark matter, matter of mass of the beast between 6, 7, 10, 12, 10 to the 12 GeV. The idea is that they annihilate to TT bar. The TT bar eventually decays into neutrinos, so the same. You look, so these things are supposed to be accumulated in the center of the sun. So you look for a signal of neutrinos from the center of the sun, and you interpret it in terms of this super heavy dark matter. There were previously limits from state detectors and some Earth analysis. And that was done with IceCube 22, actually, and we swept this. So all this is rejected right now. So in one go, IceCube 22 kind of canceled the parameter space quite dramatically. And then there is from direct detection, this one. So it's pretty disfavored. This super heavy dark matter.
Yeah, let me just mention that it's the phenomenology of these particles is quite weird, actually, if you do yeah. things carefully. So for instance, depending on what the annihilation cross section is, these things can you collect these particles at the very center of the sun, like within meters from the center of the sun. And they do very funny things, you know, they can become self-gravitating and destroy the sun, they can burst, you know, they do very, you know, strange things. So when you make this process space, you should be aware that
there are limits.
You know, one has to be very careful when
Yeah, so here we come again to one choice of them. So we choose this annihilation. So it's, yeah. we also were, this work in progress, we're doing this secluded dark matter thing where you have the standard model particles, the dark matter sector completely decoupled, they don't interact between themselves, they only interact between a mediator. This is a framework of models, it's not just a single model because you can choose the origin of this mediator. But the idea is that the dark matter accumulated in the sun annihilates only to this mediator. And if this mediator is long-lived enough, it can exit the sun and reach the Earth and decay in the Earth. So if it decays into two muons, these muons are boosted, and the signal in the detector is two parallel tracks, as opposed to one single track from any other process. So the analysis here is based on identifying or characterizing the rank of emission of two parallel and closed tracks. And closed means that we cannot distinguish them by, we cannot know, I mean, we cannot fit two tracks going. They are a few meters, separated a few meters. Our strings are 125 meters separated. So what we see is kind of very bright muon going through. So something which is, looks like a muon, but it's emitting more light. So there is ways, looking at how the waveforms in the optical modules are hit and so on. So there are ways to distinguish these two things. And the idea is, in the end, to have a plot on limit or sensitivity like that, and the flux of these things as a function of the lifetime of these things. And then if you come with your model, you can see if it's disfavored or not. Again, it's not. This is a framework of where you can fit many models, not just a single. So this is a work in progress that we're doing now, which you can also kind of only do when the detector is big enough because of the characteristics of the events you're looking for. If the detector was it's small, you can just saturate it or something like that.
So these rules out things on the
I mean, you need a lot of flux to get something which decays.
What sort of couplings model coupling, not to decay, outside the sun? It's not a gauge coupling, what's this?
No, well, I mean,
it's something like
this thing can decay anywhere. So there will be some models which predict the lifetime, which is happens to be at our detector.
Yeah, but these particles are produced inside the sun, right? And
yes.
They decay to something outside the sun, right?
No.
So they are long-lived particles.
Yes, they're long.
So how, I mean, how would you produce this long-lived? Or is that a kinematical mechanism? Or is just a coupling which you suppress, right? Something like that.
I have some slides.
Symmetry or something like that.
I have.
So it's a function.
Yeah, that's the most natural thing.
All of things you mentioned are possible. So there are more.
Yeah,
no, I mean, there are more. No.
What sort of couplings or models are these?
I have a I have some slides.
Photon that only decays through small kinetic mixing with the photon. At that
so what is this coupling size?
It's arbitrary, so it can be 10 minus 3. In fact, the mixing can be 10 minus 3, 10 minus 20. It's an option. It's a free parameter. But he's able to constrain something that whose decay length is all of the Earth's sun, just so imagine it's going to be 10 minus 10-ish epsilon. So, but I don't know.
I mean, because this flux also is, you can relate it to the coupling here.
You just have to get it out of the sun, that's all.
Well, no, we have to get it far enough, right? So you really want the business to be,
you want to be at least
light, and you want to be aware of the sun. Right.
No, I mean, the where it cuts off in sensitivity there, that's the radius of the sun. So you just have to get it out of the sun for them to have some sensitivity. Right?
Well, out of the sun and to the Earth.
Yes.
I mean, do you have a window? You have a quite narrow window of these things to decay for us to be sensitive to them.
So if it's narrow, why are there seven orders of magnitude you're sensitive to here? I don't understand this.
The reason is because if the lifetime is longer or equal to the Earth's sun distance, then the solar fraction that decays.
Right. So long as it's long enough, you can have sensitivity.
Yeah, but if you decay right outside the sun, then you live in an exponential, and then nothing will basically light disappears.
Yeah, so the point where this, those curves stop is probably the sun-Earth distance, right? In C tau. So the lower limit is the size of the sun.
No.
And the upper limit is the sun-Earth distance in the bounds on C tau, right?
So the bottom there, it's 10^5 meters, boosted by a factor of 1,000, so that's 10^8 meters, which is about the radius of the sun. So I agree. It's the radius of the sun, not the Earth's sun radius.
So then you have about, 10^14.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Before it stops.
So you just have to get them out of the sun to start being sensitive.
Yeah, so they were just saying out of the sun and that it decays, you know, before reaching to the earth.
Like, yes.
That's what rockets
see.
Good.
Okay. And again, there is a lot of possibilities on building these models on how these things couple.
And if you just take some sort of, you know, gut completion or something, and you throw things in that with the secluded sector's charge and with electric charge, and imagine they're on the same order of magnitude or something, you, and for a GeV particle, you naively expect a mixing of like 10 to the minus 5. Which gives you something in this range. And this is a very natural thing to measure.
Other framework would be this freezing, right? That's the kind of scoping stuff that you need if you want to freeze in the downtime instead of
Sure.
Having the freeze out. Well, then I think you need lighter. If you do have dark working companies, you need much lighter focus.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be.
Okay, so is that a result or is that an expected sensitivity?
That's a sensitivity. Oh.
Okay, so you haven't performed this analysis on data yet?
No. Okay. We have simulated two masses of this intermediate thing and optimized analysis, applied the cuts on the Monte Carlo to get the sensitivity, but not on data. Mm-hmm.
And how do you distinguish one very energetic neutrino from two not so energetic ones in the Cherenkov plane?
So it goes, we measure the amount of light per unit track length, more or less. These are supposed to be minimum ionizing. If you would have a high energetic muon, which emits catastrophic losses, the light is not so smoothly distributed per unit track length. So that was the handle.
Carlos, can we try to wrap up within like a few minutes? Or?
Yes, I only have to go through the galactic searches quickly. So again, we have done two types of galactic searches, a galactic halo and galactic center. The galactic center for us, is in the northern hemisphere. So the galactic halo, we can see some part of the halo from IceCube. And, well, you can look, you can take this as a signal region and the opposite side of the sky as a background region and make just a counting of events using our neutrino sky map. So we have done this. You can relate the number of events you count with the annihilation cross-section of that matter, assuming some halo model and some particle physics. So this is what you measure, your sky map in neutrinos. You assume a halo model, you assume a particle physics, in this case neutralinos annihilating, and you put a limit or constrain the annihilation cross-section of these particles. We have done two types of this analysis. One, which is just counting events, and we have done also a multiple analysis like the cosmic microwave people do. So in principle, what you see in the halo is a big, large-scale anisotropy, if you want. So you can develop our sky in spherical harmonics. So this is our events, how many events we have in a given direction. You can standard in spherical harmonics, you can define a measure of how much you have, how much intensity you have in one side or another, depending on these coefficients. This big A, the big A depends on the small a, some function. So you define this measure. The background, which is just atmospheric neutrinos, would be the blue curve, and then when you make an observation, you look at your sky map, you count. This variable takes a precise value, which is in this case is that one. And you can arrive at these kind of limits on the annihilation cross section of neutralinos versus neutralino mass. Here we have the multiple analysis, which I just showed is the red lines. And the guest counting analysis is the blue lines, one thing, though. This is with ice cube 79, and the blue lines is with ice cube 22. So it's kind of two different detectors.
So this is
limits from Fermi. And in this case, so we choose one, I mean, you have to choose one type of Halley model, which is NFW. If you change Halley models, the uncertainty is this, the thickness of the lines. So we are not so sensitive at the on the actual Halley model that we use. Mainly because we are looking at the dark matter contribution distribution here in the halo. If you go to the galactic center, things are a bit different.
How much better will you get? I mean, when I compare your ice cube 22 to ice cube 79, there's some channels that doesn't seem to improve very much. So
at high energy, you don't improve much because.
But how much better will you get?
With what? With 86? Again, not much in this,
so this is pretty much the end.
Area. So from here on is just the lifetime. And as I told you before, maybe here we can lower a bit the at low energies. Yes, because of improvements of analysis, not because of improvement of geometry.
When you made your test statistics needed for some low matter processing, isn't this diluting the power of the test?
We have a maximum. We don't sum over all of them. I think we reach 180 or 100, more or less.
Okay, or, right. You can imagine if you have statistics that speaks out the shape of your expected signal, you could do much better than just averaging over all of them, which is you're diluting.
Essentially weighing the ones that you're interested in the most.
More, that's right. The ones where this ball stands out with the background. There's a reason why.
Yeah, no, this we might want to talk to you with your expert on that. Because, I mean, this is the first analysis we do on this type, and we're still a bit on the learning curve on this technique.
So you have some template, I guess, you're saying, for these methods.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so the inner filter will be trivial to do, it looks like.
Okay, so that. Okay, so that I can talk to you guys while I'm here. Because that was.
Even in that case, I mean, one should check whether it is interesting and useful to do in the sense that one should compare the sensitivities of this is what we were discussing before, to gamma rays and to neutrinos.
Yeah, that's another one.
Maybe for these channels, for Bs and Ws, gamma ray constraints are hollow and the halo analysis of gamma ray constraints really ruled out anything that can be improved.
And actually, I'm going to show another plot.
Depends how much effort you want to put in.
Yeah, not that I'm getting 5 orders
of magnitude. I'm going to show another plot later because also, so this is this kind of multiple analysis. We have 529 just the counting experiment without this multiple, and you also get similar to results. Galactic center lies in the southern hemisphere, so we can only do it now where we can define this fiducial volume region. I will not go into the details, and let me go to, I think that's my last plot. So here you see a kind of summary of what we have concerning annihilation cross-section versus neutrino mass from the galactic halo, galactic center, and even looking at nearby dwarf galaxies. And we have also some sensitivity of the complete, not the complete, ice cube 79. So, by parts. So this is the halo, not really. Ice cube 22, halo analysis, ice cube 40 galactic center analysis using a fiducial volume defining starting tracks. Ice cube 79, all these. We have divided also in low energy and high energy because of this fiducial volume thing. So this ice cube 79, the latest ones. And these black curves are from looking at nearby galaxies. we took all the nearby dwarf galaxies, we stacked them together to increase the possible signal, and that's this limit. And if you look at the Virgo cluster, you get this. So we are in this.
What about the Virgo cluster?
What?
It's the subhalos, which makes me nervous because we have no idea what that boost factor looks like, right?
There is no boost factor, I think. It's an extended source for us.
Why does it say subhalos?
And
yeah, I think you made an assumption about subhalos that boosts the signals.
Ah, yeah, sorry. But actually, I don't recall which one of them
don't
was.
There
is an assumption. But okay, yes, but you can have uncertainty there. Now, so this is where we are with different analysis and different detectors. And if you want to take something home, take this blue line, because this is the latest analysis with the ICM-79. Okay, so let me give you an awareness slide for theories. So we have 1 kilometer cube of instrumented ice with optical modules. We can detect all flavors, muon tracks and cascades. We can define through-going, starting and contained events. So it reaches, so we cover a wide range of neutrino energies from order 10 GeV to PV. And we can look at all the sky at once and continuously. So if we have any model of exotic physics which involves neutrinos, we can probably prove it. And that's, then, yeah, that's it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much, Carlos. You'll be around for the rest of the June.
Yes, I'm here to check stuff.